This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Running Dream by Gwendolyn Vendranen, read for you by Laura Flanagan. Part 1. Finish Line. Chapter 1. My life is over. Behind the morphine dreams is the nightmare of reality. A reality I can't face. I cry myself back to sleep, wishing, pleading, praying that I will wake up from this. But the same nightmare always awaits me. "Shh," my mother whispers. "It'll be okay." But her eyes are swollen and red, and I know she doesn't believe what she's saying. My father? Now that's a different story. He doesn't even try to lie to me. What's the use? He knows what this means. My hopes, my dreams, my life, it's over. The only one who seems unfazed is Dr. Wells.
"Hello there, Jessica,"
he says. I don't know if it's day or night, the second day or the first.
"How are you feeling?"
I just stare at him. What am I supposed to say? Fine? He inspects my chart.
"So, let's have a look, shall we?"
He pulls the covers off my lap, and I find myself face to face with the truth. My right leg has no foot, no ankle, no shin. It's just my thigh, my knee, and a stump wrapped in a mountain of gauze. My eyes flood with tears as Dr. Wells removes the bandages and inspects his handiwork. I turn away, only to see my mother fighting back tears of her own. "It'll be okay," she tells me, holding tight to my hand. "We'll get through this." Dr. Wells is maddeningly cheerful.
"This looks excellent, Jessica. Nice vascular flow, good color. You're already healing beautifully."
I glance at the monstrosity below my knee. It's red and bulging at the end. Fat staples run around my stump like a big ugly zipper, and the skin is stained dirty yellow.
"How's the pain?" he asks. "Are you managing okay?"
I wipe away my tears and nod because the pain in my leg is nothing compared to the one in my heart. None of their meds will make that one go away. He goes on cheerfully.
"I'll order a shrinker sock to control the swelling. Your residual limb will be very tender for a while, and applying the shrinker sock may be uncomfortable at first, but it's important to get you into one. Reducing the swelling and shaping your limb is the first step in your rehabilitation."
A nurse appears to rebandage me as he makes notes in my chart and says,
"A prosthetist will be in later today to apply it."
Tears continue to run down my face. I don't seem to have the strength to hold them back. Dr. Wells softens.
"The surgery went beautifully, Jessica."
He says this like he's trying to soothe away reality.
"And considering everything, you are actually very lucky. You're alive, and you still have your knee, which makes a huge difference in your future mobility. BK amputees have it much easier than AK amputees."
"BK, AK?" my mom asks.
"I'm sorry," he says, turning to my mother. "Below knee, above knee. In the world of prosthetic legs, it's a critical difference."
He prepares to leave.
"There will obviously be an adjustment period, but Jessica is young and fit, and I have full confidence that she will return to a completely normal life."
My mother nods, but she seems dazed, like she's wishing my father was there to help her absorb what's being said. Dr. Wells flashes a final smile at me.
"Focus on the positive, Jessica. We'll have you up and walking again in short order."
This from the man who sawed off my leg. He whooshes from the room, leaving a dark, heavy cloud of the unspoken behind. My mother smiles and coos reassuringly, but she knows what I'm thinking. What does it matter? I'll never run again. Chapter 2. I am a runner. That's what I do. That's who I am. Running is all I know or want or care about. It was a race around a soccer field in third grade that swept me into a real love of running, breathing the sweet smell of spring grass, sailing over dots of blooming clover, beating all the boys. After that, I couldn't stop. I ran everywhere, raced everyone. I loved the wind across my cheeks, through my hair. Running aired out my soul. It made me feel alive. And now, I'm stuck in this bed knowing I will never run again. Chapter 3. The prosthetist is stocky and bald, and he tells me to call him Hank. He tries to talk to me about a fake leg, but I make him stop. I just can't listen to this. He gets the nurse to put a new bandage on my leg, one that's thinner with less gauze. I'm cold. The room's cold. Everything feels cold. I want to cover up, but Hank is getting ready to put on the shrinker sock. It's like a long, toeless tube sock. He pulls it through a short length of wide PVC pipe, then folds the top part of the sock back over the pipe. I don't understand what he's going to do with it, and I don't care. Until he slips the pipe over my stump. Ah! I gasp as pressure and pain shoot up my leg. I'm sorry, Hank says, transferring the sock from the pipe onto my leg as he pulls the pipe off. We're almost done. Half the tube sock is now dangling from my stump. Hank slides a small ring up the dangling end, then stretches out the rest of the sock and doubles it up over the ring and over my stump. There's pressure, throbbing. But Hank assures me it'll feel better soon.
The area is swollen, he tells me, pooling with blood. The shrinker sock will help reduce the swelling and speed your recovery. Once the wound is healed and the volume of your leg is reduced, we can fit you with a preparatory prosthesis.
How long will that take? My mother asks. Her voice starts out shaky, but she tries to steady it. Hank whips out a soft tape measure and circles the end of my stump.
That's hard to say.
His mind seems to wander, so my mom asks, well, in a typical situation? Hank takes a deep breath.
Typical is a person in poor health, someone with circulatory problems, someone who's old, overweight, or suffering from diabetes.
He glances at me.
A case like Jessica's will not have the same timeline. Her recovery will be much quicker.
So what is their expected recovery time? My mother asks, and she's sounding testy.
We usually don't fit them with a preparatory prosthesis for about 6 months.
6 months? My mother gasps.
But Jessica could have hers in a fraction of that time. It all depends on her healing and how soon she can tolerate it.
They talk some more, but I stop listening. What does it matter how long it takes? I'll never recover. I can't even see how I'll ever even adjust. Chapter 4. I close my eyes and drift off. I see the race. Vanessa steals in lane 5, stretching out. Her long nails painted deep red, her racing glasses flashing back the late morning sun. I remember thinking that Vanessa has been good for me. Her superior attitude, her mind games, her domination of the 400 meter, it's been good for me. Vanessa glances over her shoulder, waiting for me to get into my blocks before she gets down in hers. It's part of her game. She likes to be the last one standing. This time, I don't mind. I'm through being sucked into her psych out. I feel calm, confident. Coach Cairo has been helping me focus. He's been building me up mentally and physically, coaching me for this moment. I give Vanessa a little smile and nod from my position in lane 4. She's in red and yellow, Langston High's colors. I'm in Liberty High's blue and gold. Even my colors feel light, like the sun and the sky floating above me. I'm down in the blocks now, ready to fly.
Vanessa makes her final adjustments, then holds steady. The gun goes off, and all runners shoot forward. It's a fury of steps, spikes against track. They thunder all around me, but somehow sound miles away. By the first bend, we find our stride. My kick is good, strong and long. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. My arms are pumping, but they're smooth, almost relaxed. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. My breathing's open, flowing, and I barely feel my feet touching down. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. Suddenly I'm floating, flying, soaring around the track. The thunder fades behind me, and the staggered start has me at a mental advantage. I can see Vanessa, but she can only feel me behind her moving in. At the 200-meter mark, the field has widened, all except for Vanessa and me. We've tightened. We crest the 300, then face rigor mortis bend. Vanessa knows I'm here, on her tail. We're down to grit and guts, so I dig in, dig deep. She does the same. We battle along the straightway, my legs burning, aching, empty. Shoulder to shoulder, I force one last push and duck over the finish line in front of her. 55 flat, Cairo shouts. 55 flat. It's a new personal best for me. A new record for the league. It's also the last race of my life. My finish line. Chapter 5. Nurses come in and out. Conversations happen around me. Whispers like a heavy fog hang on in my mind. But then there's my father's voice and Dr. Wells's. Outside my room, their words drift in through the crack in the doorway. My father asks about things he's researched online, rigid removable dressings, speedier recoveries, eye pops. He sounds like a doctor. Dr. Wells's replies revolve around small-town practicalities, insurance allowances, and the tried-and-true methods employed by Mercy Hospital. Dad comes in and checks on me, and although he pretends to be upbeat, he's irked. He likes to fix things now. He checks out the stump protector that's been put on over the shrinker sock. It holds my legs straight and keeps me from bumping the wound. He seems pleased with it and throws around phrases like controlling edema, and preventing knee flexion contracture. He sounds like he knows what he's talking about, but really he's a self-employed handyman. And I'm not something he can fix. Chapter 6. The call light's been on for 15 minutes, and I'm just sick of waiting. I'm sick of bedpans. Hand me the crutches, I growl at my mother. She's unsure. I haven't done so well with a physical therapist. Hand them to me. She does, and I swing my legs over the edge of the bed. Carefully. Slowly. It takes a little doing, but I stand, supported by the crutches. I'm already panting. My mother pushes along my IV stand as I hobble toward the bathroom. You're doing great, she says, but she's wrong. I'm dizzy, shaking. Maybe I should get the nurse, she asks as I come to a halt, exhausted from the effort. I shake my head, angry that this is so hard. You're doing great, my mom repeats as I start up again. I'm so proud of you. My hands death grip the crutches and I hobble forward. A few days ago, I ran a 55 flat in the 400 meter. Today, I am taking 5 minutes to go 20 feet. When I finally get to the bathroom, I see myself in the mirror. Matted hair, puffy eyes, chapped lips. I move on, then pass the crutches off to my mother, grab the support bar, and begin to lower myself onto the toilet. But I'm weak, and my good leg gives way. My mother gasps as I fall onto the seat with a painful thump, and then fusses as I pee all over my gown. It's okay, she says as I bawl into my hands. It was your first try. What do you expect? She turns and calls, "Nurse! Nurse!" Then tries again to soothe me. It will get easier. Things will get better. But in her eyes, I can see fear. Fear that her words are lies. Lies, lies, lies. "Nurse!" she calls again, louder, more desperately. This time, one appears. "Oh, my," she says when she's sized up the situation. "Do we need a new gown?" It takes the three of us 10 minutes to wash and redress me. Another 5 for me to hobble back to bed. They help me under the covers, and after I'm tucked safely inside, my mother brushes back my hair and kisses my forehead. I manage a weak smile, then close my eyes, destroyed. Chapter 7. Rigor Mortis Bend. It's a place in the 400-meter race where every cell of your body locks up. Your lungs ache for air, your quads turn to cement, your arms pump desperately, but they're stiff and feel like lead. Rigor Mortis Bend is the last turn of any track, and at Liberty High, you're greeted with a headwind. The finish line comes into view, and you will yourself toward it, but the wind pushes you back. Your body begs you to give up, and the whole world seems to grind into slow motion. Your determination is all that's left. It forces your muscles to fire, forces you to stay in the race, forces you to survive the pain of this moment. Your teammates scream for you to push, 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 push! You can do it! But their voices are muffled by the gasping for air, the pounding of earth, the pumping of blood, the need to collapse. Rigor Mortis Bend. I feel like I'm living on Rigor Mortis Bend. Chapter 8. My sense of smell seems heightened. Sometimes it's what wakes me up. And it's not the sickly smell of hospital. It's flowers. Beautiful, bursting bouquets of flowers. I have no idea who they're from, although my mother has read me every single card. She's sniffed every rose, every carnation, and has analyzed every exotic bloom. Stargazer lilies, irises, parrot tulips, tuberoses, sweet williams, columbines, amaryllis. My mother's a nut for flowers. The helium balloons sway in the gentle air currents or stand at attention. "Get well," they command. They're my very own round-faced cheering squad there in the background, peeking through the fog in my mind. Get well. But I'm not sick. I'm crippled. Disabled. A gimp. Food arrives and overpowers the fragrance of flowers. Mashed potatoes, gravy-covered pork, or maybe turkey, vegetable medley. "You've got to eat," my mother says. I sip the juice. "Just a few bites," she says, and I try the potatoes just to make her happy. My stomach flinches. The smell is overwhelming. "I'm tired," I tell her and push the tray away. "Please, can you get this out of here?" She takes the tray and leaves without a word. I close my eyes and drift off, only to be awakened by her standing over me with a dish of Jell-O. "Let's try a few bites of this," she says, spooning some into my mouth. "It's cool, refreshing." "Thanks," I whisper. My lips are dry and chapped. I lick them, then accept another bite. "That's my girl," she says, as I take the dish from her. She smiles at me and says it again. "That's my girl." Chapter 9. The nurse told me it's Wednesday. That makes it day 5, or 4.5, depending on how you count. I'm off the morphine drip, but still on pain meds, and my head stays cloudy. A thin curtain separates me from the moans of my new neighbor. It smells sickly in here now, like diarrhea and disinfectant. My flowers are drooping and dropping petals. The balloons are sagging too, losing air. It's like they're tired of trying to cheer me up, like they want to give up too. There have been so many calls, but I don't want to talk. Not to anyone. Mom thinks I should, thinks talking to people would help me. Dad tells them I'm not ready, then kindly but firmly hangs up. Except when Coach Cairo calls, then he's more firm than kind. He's mad at him, I think, although I'm not sure why. I don't even want to talk to my sister. Kaylee's been in and out, but I always tell her I'm tired, or I just pretend to be asleep. Mom keeps pressuring me to spend more time with her, but Kaylee's only 13, still in middle school, and I know how freaked out she is to see me like this. I'm freaked out to see me like this, and I'm a junior in high school. I'm supposed to be the strong one. I've always been the strong one. But what am I supposed to say to her, to anyone? Hey, don't worry, I'm going to be fine. Then what I want to say is, why me? Why me? Chapter 10. The physical therapist comes in and makes me get up. Makes me crutch over to a chair. My mother watches as he stretches out my legs and both arms and then has me use weights and resistance bands. He shows me how to use a towel to stretch and strengthen my limbs. I don't care.
You need to keep your body going, he tells me. Work it as much as you can.
I'm drained, breathless. I get back into bed and wish hard for him to go away. He turns to my mother.
Encourage her to do these as often as she'll tolerate.
When he finally does leave, there's a timid knock on the door. And when my mom sees my best friend standing there with a big get-well teddy bear, she looks at me, then waves her in.
You need this, she whispers.
And on her way out, she murmurs to Fiona, a quick visit, okay? She's still very fragile.
Fragile.
Me. Fiona smiles, and I take in the beautiful sight of her. New highlights in her already blonde hair. Matching light blue hoodie and shorts. Asics on her feet. And those legs. Long, tan, smooth. I never really realized how beautiful legs could be. She sees me staring and tugs at the white trim of her shorts. Ugh, I'm an idiot. You're fine, I manage. No, I'm an idiot. But you brought a cool bear, I tell her, and actually grin. She hands it over and sits in a chair. His name's Lucas, unless you want me to name him something else. He just seems like a Lucas to me, so that's what I've been calling him. This is like the 20th time I've been here. They always tell me I can't see you. I wore pants every time, too. She bursts into tears, and then lunges toward me and hugs me like I have never been hugged before. I am so sorry, Jess. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to do. I've been so scared. I miss you so much. I hug her back, and the lump in my throat hurts. Hurts hard. I don't know what to say either. I finally choke out. And I don't know what to do. I'm dying in here. Tears roll down my cheeks as we look at each other. Am I pathetic or what?
Pathetic is so not you, she says with a sniff.
And you're not dying. You're alive. She hugs me hard again.
Thank God you're alive. The whole thing's horrible, 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 horrible.
She pulls away. But I keep thinking if you had been Lucy and she had been you, I would have died. Lucy? I ask. And for a moment, the air seems like glass. And then I remember. Finally, remember. Lucy in the seat in front of me. The light. The sounds. Screaming. Crunching. Shattering. My breath catches and I can feel it again. The pain. My foot caught, twisted, crushed. And then darkness.
blissful, painless darkness. Chapter 11.
Are you okay? Jessica, hey, hey, look at me.
Fiona's voice brings me back.
What happened to Lucy?
I choke out, but my gut's way ahead of her answer.
You don't know?
Fiona gasps.
Oh, man. She backs away. I'm an idiot. I thought for sure you knew.
She died? Fiona nods. Blinks.
She didn't suffer, she blurts out. She hit her head and was just gone.
The whole room starts spinning. Lucy. So sweet. Her first year running. Joined the team to make friends. I brace myself. Who else?
That's it. The rest of us are just cut and bruised and scarred for life.
She's serious, and for a moment, I forget about my leg.
My father said the guy who hit us was killed. And good riddance to that loser, she says.
Was he drunk?
He might as well have been. He was hauling a load of wrecked cars to a junkyard with bad brakes. He missed a turn, went off the side of the road, barreled down the embankment, and smashed into us. Talk about irresponsible. He torpedoed a school bus.
Torpedoed. That word was exactly right. Fiona eyes the covers. So, do I get to see? Oh, yeah. The leg.
You don't have to, she says.
Her face crinkles. Am I being an idiot again? I think about it, then flip back the covers and let her stare. When she's whiter than my sheets, I cover it back up and say,
you should see it unwrapped.
Why couldn't they save it? She asks, and her voice is choked, almost inaudible.
Smashed beyond repair, I tell her.
And I feel odd. Like I should be crying. My mother eases into the room with a smile. Are we doing okay? She asks. We're both dead quiet. Fiona starts blinking like there's too much light in the room, then says,
I guess my time's up.
She gives me a long, hard hug and whispers,
you can do this.
Then she says goodbye to my mother and walks her long, tan legs out the door. Chapter 12. I'm in an endless blur of exhausted days and sleepless nights. The nurses are nice about my pain meds. It's the only way I get any sleep. Dr. Wells visits every morning and leaves with a cheery prognosis.
You're healing beautifully, Jessica. Keep up the good work.
The physical therapist teaches me how to care for my stump. I have to learn to clean it, learn to dress and protect it, learn to massage it and desensitize it, learn to not vomit at the sight of it. I finally have a real visit with Kaylee. I try to be brave, but it's hard.
When can you come home?
She asks, after we've dispensed with the small talk.
I don't know if I want to, I say with a smart-alecky grin. They wait on me hand and foot here. They clean up after me and give me massages. You gonna do that when I get home?
A part of her's not sure I'm kidding, so I pull her in and whisper, as soon as I can, okay? Then I give her some space and ask, how's Sherlock holding up? You walking him for me?
Dad is.
Well, you get out there and do it too. He'll chew up all my shoes if he's cooped up too long. I smirk at her.
Okay, so he can have the right ones, but don't let him anywhere near the left ones.
She doesn't laugh, and I'm feeling dumb for trying so hard. She also doesn't ask to see my stump. She just hugs me some more and tells me she loves me, and after a game of gin rummy, Mom gently informs her that it's time to go. I wave goodbye and tell her, stay out of trouble. And hey, stay out of my closet, too. You cannot have my clothes. You hear me? I'm coming home, so don't even think about taking my stuff.
You were wonderful, Mom whispers after she's passed Kaylee off to Dad. Absolutely wonderful.
Thanks, I tell her, but my whole chest seems to collapse under the effort of that single empty word. Suddenly, I'm wrung out, exhausted from the effort of pretending to be strong. Chapter 13. I do my physical therapy. Mom makes me.
It'll make you strong, darling. Dad makes me. You don't want to spend the rest of your life in bed, Jess. Get up.
Fiona makes me.
I miss you. We need to get out of here.
The phone rings as I am panting from a therapy session with Fiona. She snatches it up and says, Jessica Carlisle's room, Nurse Bartlett speaking. Her mouth stretches into a long pink O as she turns to me. Her eyes are enormous. One moment, please, she says in a very professional manner, then hands the phone over with the mouthpiece palmed.
It's Gavin Vance.
I take the phone from her. Hello? Jessica, it's Gavin. Something about hearing his voice stuns me silent. I have wished for this call for almost 2 years.
Gavin Vance? He says.
And I imagine him wondering how there could possibly be any confusion. After all, he is the mayor's son.
Oh, hey, I say back. I just wanted to say, you know, I hope you're, you know.
His voice trails off.
Back on my feet soon? I ask.
He laughs. It's a nervous laugh, mixed with relief.
I know, I tell him. What can you say, huh?
Yeah, he says, with another nervous laugh.
Everyone feels terrible about what happened.
Not as bad as me, I quip. He laughs again, but this time it's not so nervous.
Hey, I'm doing an article for the Liberty Bell, and,
About the accident?
Right. There are a lot of rumors flying around, and all of a sudden my body flashes hot.
Look, I'm not up to reliving that nightmare for the school paper, okay?
No, I'm sorry. I'm just wondering, well, everyone's wondering when you're gonna be back at school.
I'm still feeling hot and shaky. I'm not sure, I say quietly. Not for a while. And even though this is Gavin Vance, I really want to hang up on him. So I say, I need to get back to my physical therapy and end the conversation.
Fiona is completely bowled over. Gavin Vance called you!
A dream come true, I grumble, because really, if it took losing a leg to get him to notice me, I'd rather be ignored.
Chapter 14. My mother comes in with a to-go bag from Angelo's.
Lasagna? I ask.
She beams as she opens the sack.
What else?
It smells heavenly. And for the first time since I got rushed into Mercy Hospital, I'm hungry. Really, truly hungry.
Oh, thank you,
I say, scooting up in bed so she can wheel the tray across my lap. It takes a few scoots because the stump is very tender, still mad at the world. Hospital regulations say that I have to wear a gown, so when I'm situated, my mother shakes out a napkin, tucks it in my gown collar, and fusses until everything's arranged and I'm digging in.
Mmm,
I tell her with a contented smile.
Oh, it's wonderful.
She's relieved, I know, and I'm happy to not be pretending.
Angelo's lasagna is amazing on any ordinary day, but at this moment, it is the best thing I have ever tasted.
I close my eyes and just savor it. And then an excruciating pain shoots up my leg. My eyes fly open and I scream,
"Get off my leg!" Only my mother is nowhere near my leg. She's standing right beside me. "Something's on my leg," I cry. "Get it off!" "There's nothing on your leg," she says, looking from me to the covers back to me. "Absolutely nothing." I'm at a slant, and I can't really see what's past the hospital tray, but I know she's crazy. The pain is so real, so strong. There is something on my shin, twisting my foot. I shove the tray aside before I remember that I don't have a shin or a foot. "Another phantom pain?" my mother asks quietly. I nod and stare at the flat covers where my foot should be. Every time I have a phantom pain, it freaks me out. They're unpredictable and always different. Sometimes the missing part of my leg burns. Sometimes it stabs. Sometimes it feels twisted. Sometimes it's a combination. The nerves are cut, but they're still connected to my brain. "Do you want me to get the nurse?" my mother asks. And her glowing face has been replaced by a pale, worried one. "No," I tell her, "it's going away." But I'm panting, sweating. Her mouth quivers uncertainly. "Are you sure?" I nod and pull the tray back toward me. And after a minute, I pretend to be hungry, but really, I'm not. The pain has made me nauseous. And on the other side of the tray, I can still feel my leg. It may be gone, but that's not stopping it from insisting it's still there. Chapter 15. I have the dream again. Dawn is breaking. Sherlock's whole body is wagging as he dances in a circle by the front door. We ease out of the house, then bound down the porch steps, turning right when we hit the street to head toward the river. The world is quiet. No cars, no people, no hustle and bustle. Just the rhythmic padding of our feet against pavement. Sherlock is happy beside me. His white fur seems to flow through the morning mist, and he doesn't miss a beat. I turn, he turns. I speed up, he speeds up. No leash to connect us, no commands to control him. We're bound by the joy of running. We reach the river, and the air is heavenly. It sparkles my face, washes my lungs, fills me with a sense of fluid motion. I glide beneath the trees, transform into wind. We breeze up to Agri Bridge, and I begin the long sprint across it. My legs and lungs burn, but I welcome the pain. I'm stronger than pain. Sherlock races ahead, and I let him. He lives to run the bridge, reaching two legs forward, kicking two legs back. He waits for me on the other side, wagging, panting, grateful for this stretch of freedom. He falls in beside me as I drop back the pace and glide along the streets, back past familiar houses, back home. On the porch again, he kisses me and pants as I tousle his ears. "Good boy," I tell him. "You are such a good boy." The sun is brighter now. Our sleepy neighborhood is stirring, waking up. And then, with a gasp, so do I. Chapter 16. I roll over and check the clock, check the chair. 4:28 a.m. The chair's empty. I told Mom she didn't have to stay nights anymore, that I was okay. I said it with conviction. She wanted badly to believe me, almost as badly as I wanted her to. It's easy to see from the dark circles, the haunted eyes. She needs me to be okay. "I'd switch places with you, Jessica, in a heartbeat." She said it when the doctors explained that my leg was hopeless, and I know she's thought about it every day since. She'd give up both her legs to give me back the one I lost. There's no doubt in my mind. But she can't, and I hate that she's been sleeping in the chair. So she's gone, and I'm alone. I feel trapped, scared, angry. And so I cry. Silent tears burn, then pool in my ears. But they don't change a thing.
I wipe my eyes and check the clock again. 4:32 a.m. It's my 8th day with no leg. An eternity.
Chapter 17. Fiona visits wearing black leggings and a flowing purple top. And heels. They're low, but still, heels? Definitely not typical Fiona wear.
Were you at church? I ask, sitting up.
She nods, solemnly. And now I see that her eyes are rimmed red.
Lucy's memorial service, I say with a small voice. I forgot.
She pulls up a chair and dissolves into it.
It was awful.
Well, everyone said it was moving and beautiful and perfect, but I thought it was awful. They had a huge blow-up picture of her and flowers everywhere, and people got up and told funny stories about her, and they had her ballet slippers from 6th grade on display and her favorite scarf wrapped over the podium. I kept staring at the picture. I wanted to look somewhere else, but I kept staring at it.
I pass her Lucas the bear. She hugs him fiercely and starts sobbing.
Why did she have to die? Why? She's not expecting an answer, and that's good because I sure don't have one.
I rest my hand on her shoulder, knowing I should be grateful I'm still alive, but somehow I'm not. I know it's selfish, but I can't help thinking that Lucy is the lucky one. For Lucy, there's no pain, no rehab, no learning to live disabled. There's no anger or self-revulsion. For Lucy, there's just resting in peace.
Chapter 18. Fiona apologizes for crying, then hugs me and tells me how glad she is I'm alive. My secret thoughts feel even more selfish. Then she switches gears.
Oh!
What? I ask with a laugh. Her eyes are enormous, and I know what this means. Gossip.
Guess who was turning to Gavin for comfort at the memorial service?
Turning to him for comfort? So it's someone who was friends with Lucy?
No, she totally snubbed her.
Okay. I look for clues among the ceiling tiles, hoping she'll just tell me, but Fiona's big into 20 questions, and I've only asked one.
So, it's someone on the team?
Her head bobbles like crazy.
A sprinter?
She shakes her head.
Mid-distance. Long distance?
Shake.
So she does field events?
Nod.
Long jump? High jump?
Discus?
Shake.
Nod.
Shake.
It strikes me like a bolt.
Merrill? Yes! She gasps. Can you believe that? Merrill Abrams after a guy who's not a jock.
Are you sure she wasn't just, you know, mourning Lucy?
No way. It was classic Merrill on the move.
She scowls.
You should have seen her hanging all over him. Like she'd die or faint or explode if he didn't hold her together. I heard her say, I can't bear the thought of that horrible, horrible day. She pulls a tortured face. Can you believe that? She wasn't even on the bus.
Which was true. The meet was an invitational, and Merrill hadn't qualified. Something that didn't bother her a bit. Everyone knows that Merrill's on the team so she can put team participation on her college applications next year, and track is the only sport that doesn't cut.
Gavin's too smart to fall for that, I tell her.
And what happened to Darren?
She shrugs. She got tired of him. Who knows?
But Gavin?
Talk about switching party affiliations.
Fiona snorts.
Gavin may not be a jock, but he is the mayor's son, and he's hot.
Especially since he grew that chin scruff.
Wait, Gavin has chin scruff?
She nods.
It looks seriously good on him, too.
This is really lifting my spirits, I grumble.
I'm sorry, I'm just telling you because it is so Merrill and so ridiculous. Like he's going to fall for her manipulations.
She takes a deep breath.
So, when are you getting out of here? I am sick of school without you.
My stomach suddenly tightens. Dad's talked about me going back to school, but I can't picture it. It scares me to think about facing all those people, seeing everyone walking, watching them hurry up and down steps, knowing that after school, all my friends will meet at the track to run. I look away. Dr. Wells says I'll go home soon, but I don't know about school. My voice drifts off pathetically, so I say, I've been thinking that I should do some sort of homeschool program.
A homeschool program? Like on the internet? No way. No way. That would be like the worst thing for you.
She leans forward.
Look, I'll push you. You can do this.
At first, I think she means she'll push me to get back to school, push me to face the world, but the pit of my stomach understands what she really means.
You'll push me in a wheelchair? Of course! There's no way you can cover that campus on crutches, and it's going to be a while before you get your fake leg, right? So I'll deliver you to all your classes. It'll be easy.
Lucas has somehow wound up back with me, and I find myself hugging him, feeling totally panicked. I have barely figured out how to use the bathroom on my own. How will I ever manage school? Chapter 19. The staples are out. Dr. Wells says I'm his fastest healing patient ever.
I'm proud of you, Jessica. You've done an amazing job. I want to shout. I haven't done anything. I've just existed. And I want to hit him hard. I want to hit him for sawing off my leg. Hit him for being so cheerful and acting like I'm a star patient when I'm really just an angry, pathetic whiner.
Then he says the magic words. The ones I've been longing for. The ones I am terrified of. The ones I thought might never, ever come and are now suddenly here too fast.
You are ready to go home.
Today? I ask.
And it's a choked sound, somewhere between dying and gasping for life. He nods.
Assuming you pass all your PT requirements.
He looks directly at me.
You can manage your care and cleaning, change your own shrinker.
I nod.
You can walk across the room on crutches, go up and down four steps, transfer from standing to sitting, and fall safely.
These are all the things that PT has been making me do. I'm still wobbly, but I can do them. So I nod. He smiles.
Then you're going home.
I know I should thank him, but the way he says home throws me. I'm suddenly picturing a pair of ruby slippers. Slippers I can't click together because I can't. And even though they're just in my head, just something from a movie, they glitter in my mind, and I'm suddenly desperate to click my heels together and wake up in my own bed with my own dog and both legs. There's no place like home, I whisper when he's gone. No place like home. But there are no ruby slippers. There is no waking up. There's just me and my ugly, useless stump. Chapter 20. I'm dressed in sweats with the extra material of the right leg pinned up, and I've just demonstrated fall safety to a physical therapist I haven't worked with before when my mother appears.
Are you okay? She gasps.
Fine, I tell her. Then demonstrate recovery by standing up. Just passing my final exam.
You're coming home, she squeals, dancing in place.
Then she grabs the parked wheelchair and practically shoves it under me, kiss, kiss, kissing the top of my head just like she did when I was little.
You must be Jessica's mom,
the PT says with a smile.
That I am, she says, like,
being my mom is the best thing ever. He chuckles.
Well, I'm happy to report that your daughter has mastered all the necessary functional goals for release.
He scribbles on the sheet he's been quizzing me from and says,
from now on, we'll be seeing her at the rehab facility.
He hands my mother a couple of brochures and a small stack of papers, and after some pleasantries to me about keeping up the good work, he's gone. My mother packs my things as I wait in the wheelchair with Lucas the Bear in my lap. But it's another hour and a half before I'm being rolled down the corridor by a nurse. Mom's not allowed to push me. I'm not allowed to roll myself. I guess they want to make sure they get me out of here in one piece and that no one rolls off with Mercy Hospital property. Dad's waiting outside the big glass doors of the hospital's front entrance. He's holding the handles of a smaller wheelchair, one that is, apparently, all mine. "Jessica," he says, and he looks happy too. "Hey, Dad," I say, and my eyes sting with tears. It's the first real smile I've seen on him in forever. I demonstrate a flawless wheelchair transfer, and after we all say goodbye to the nurse, Dad and Mom walk me across the parking lot to Dad's van. They're all smiles and coos until I'm standing at the open passenger door trying to figure out how to transfer to a seat that's up so high. I can't swing into it. I can't exactly hop inside. I can't grab the frame of the van with both arms and hoist myself in. We have crutches, but I'm not sure how to use them in this situation. I'm just stumped. Mom tries to help, but she's really just in the way. Dad has collapsed the wheelchair and put it in back with Lucas the bear and the rest of my things, and after watching me agonize over how to get inside the van, he simply gathers me in his arms and hoists me onto the seat. "We'll figure it out, sweetheart," my mom says with a reassuring pat of my hand. "We'll figure it all out." She kisses me on the cheek. "For now, let's just get you home." She tells Dad she'll see him at the house, then goes off to her car. Dad fires up the van and tries smiling at me, but his eyes are heavy again, and I know he's thinking what I'm thinking. There's no such thing as easy. Not anymore. Chapter 21. My heart begins racing as Dad turns onto Harkin Street. I don't really know why. The whole ride has been snail-paced. Careful turns, complete stops, below-limit speeds. I can't decide if he's scared of jostling me or scared of having me home. Finally, we pull up to the curb behind my mother's car. A flood of emotions comes over me as I look at our house and see snapshots in my mind. Mud castles in the flower beds. Hide-and-seek under the porch. Dad taking the training wheels off my bike. Kickball, hula hoops. Running through the sprinklers, Sherlock as a puppy chasing his tail, Fiona and me giggling, climbing out my window and dropping to the ground. And then I notice the ramp, the one that goes up the left side of the porch steps, and the guardrail made of pipe, the one attached to the right side of the porch stairs. There are nasty scars across a cheery entrance. I face my dad. I can do steps, you know. I don't need a ramp. I don't mean to, but I sound angry. "It's just temporary," he says softly. "Until you get your leg." I grab my crutches. In the meantime, I can use crutches or hop. I open the passenger door defiantly, then look down at the curb. "You can do this," I tell myself. "You can do this. Down is way easier than up." But the curb seems miles away, and I'm suddenly gripped with fear. Dad's already around to my side, and he seems to understand that picking me up would be the wrong move to make. "Grab the handle in the frame," he says, coaching me forward. "Do it once, and you'll have it conquered." So I give up on the crutches, and I do as he says, letting him be my spotter as I swing down to earth. "See?" he says with a smile. Mom's rushing from the house. "You're here," she cries. But my dad gives her the take it easy signal as I saddle my armpits over the crutches. "Ah," she says as I swing toward the steps. She's worried. She wants me to use the wheelchair. I ignore her concerns as I hobble forward, and I can sense my dad pulling her back. At the steps, I put both crutches in my left hand, grab the pipe rail with my right, then hop up. One step. I feel off balance. Two steps. Like I should be grabbing the rail with my left hand. Three. I steady myself at the top, then saddle the crutches again and move on. To my surprise, the screen door doesn't fight me as I pull it open. Dad's disconnected the automatic closer so it swings easily and stays cooperatively to the side. I push open the front door and cross the threshold. I am shaky from the effort. My stump is throbbing. I just want to collapse. Then I smell something. Onions and oregano and garlic. Mom's spaghetti sauce heating up on the stove. I crutch forward a few steps and take a deep breath. From behind a gate in the kitchen, Sherlock lets out a happy bark. "Hey, boy," I call, which makes him go berserk. I have no ruby slippers, and I won't wake up from this dream. But still, there's no place like home. Chapter 22. Kaylee and her pack of friends blast through the door after school. Our house has always been their hangout. "Oh, hey," they say, stopping in their tracks when they see me in the hallway. It's a warm day, and they're all wearing shorts. "Hey," I say back and put on my best smile. "When did you get home?" Kaylee asks. "A little while ago," I answer. "Hi, girls," my mom calls from the kitchen. "Come on in." Kaylee's friends are trying hard not to look at my leg, and I can't help looking at theirs. None of us seem to have anything to say. I'm a stranger, a freak. "Well, I need to sit down," I finally tell them because my stump is throbbing. I sound angry, annoyed. They move aside as I crutch past them, and in a flurry of whispers, they escape up the stairs to Kaylee's room. I retreat to the family room, take my pain meds, and turn on the TV. Chapter 23. I learn to hop around the house. I stay near furniture and walls to steady myself, and although I feel like I'm lumbering and loud, it's easier than using crutches. My bed and dresser are downstairs in the family room. Instead of sleeping in the last room on the right upstairs, I'm now in the first room on the left after you come in the front door. I'm separated from the entry hall by a half wall with white balusters. I don't know where they moved the couches, but I do know they did a lot of heavy lifting to set this up for me, and that I should be more appreciative than I am. It's hard, though, because I feel like a stranger in my own house. I can't get to the things I want, I can't find the things I need, and I spend way too much time watching TV. The only time I feel halfway normal is when we're at the kitchen table. It's like seeing each other from the waist up helps us forget about the stump lurking beneath the surface. I also feel like a stranger to myself. Everything irritates me, and cheery people just make it worse. My friends call, they come by, they bring me plants and chocolate and get-well cards. They want to cheer me up. It isn't working. When they're here, I'm quiet and awkward, and I can't wait for them to leave. When they're gone, I cry. I cry and wish they'd come back. They won't, though, and I know it. I probably wouldn't either. Chapter 24. I've been pushing the clock on my pain meds, taking them early, slipping in an extra when I really need it. I tell myself that tomorrow I'll feel better, that I'll take one less rather than one extra. But the only time I feel better is when the meds kick in. I'm afraid of the pain without them, afraid of the day without them. Then I tell my mom I need a refill, and somehow my father gets involved. I hear them whispering, arguing. I hear him make a phone call, and I pray it's to the pharmacy, but I'm pretty sure it's not. I pretend to be asleep when he comes to see me, but this doesn't stop him. "Jessica," he whispers hoarsely, shaking my shoulder. "Hmm?" I answer, acting groggy. He's holding the bottle of pills. "How often do you take these?" "Huh?" I sit up a little. "Oh, just when I'm supposed to," I lie. "Are you sure?" I nod. He studies me. My conscience flinches, and he sees it. "The truth," he says. I shrug. "I've taken a couple extras. Only when I really needed to.
He studies me a long, hard time.